Welcome to the Underwater Podcast, where we take a deep dive into the world of underwater portrait photography, cinematography, and everything in between. With me, your host, Brett Stanley. Welcome back to the Underwater Podcast, and this week I'm chatting with cinematographer Sean Ruggieri, whose work with Red Cameras and Gates Housings has really taken him to some amazing places. We chat about how he worked with Red to refine their camera's underwater abilities, his role in the new movie The Colony, and what happens in a submarine when you need to go to the bathroom. All right, let's dive in. Sean, welcome to the Underwater Podcast.
Thank you, Brett. Glad to be here with you. I appreciate your podcast. I love it very much, man. I love your work too.
Oh, thank you, dude. Yeah. I mean, I love your work too. And I guess what I would love to know is kind of get more into that, especially in this episode of the Sean's underwater world. How did that start?
You know, I think it started way before photography for me. I think I grew up as a fish, you know, growing up in Southern California, you get to the beach every chance you can. You know, we're snorkeling, we're surfing, we're just swimming, whatever it is. And I grew up wanting to be a marine biologist. I held on to that for a while too. You know, that definitely may have strayed away from it sooner or later once, you know, other fun things got involved and you kind of lose track of that type of thing. But when I was a kid, I just gobbled up everything I could ocean, you know, any book I can get with dolphins and whales and sharks. Lived off of National Geographics and all the movies I could find. Like I said, you know, you stray away, you find other things, and then really held on to photography once I found that. My dad got me into that, and yeah, it just kind of came full circle, getting into cinema, taking film classes, really not geared anywhere towards nature filmmaking.
Yeah.
But sooner or later, it came full circle. And that, you know, that I think happened after my time at Red for a little while. And started connecting with a lot of the natural history filmmakers, and Red was really taking off in that world. So yeah. I really concentrated and dialed my efforts in on that crowd and tried to support them as much as possible. And then it ended up being them supporting me too, and kind of ushering me into the underwater cinematography world. They opened a lot of doors for me, a lot of my colleagues in that world.
And so in terms of that, you're talking about Red Cameras kind of pushing you into the underwater world?
Yeah. And I mean, that happened, you know, some years into my career at Red, where, you know, I started with them in 2007 before they actually shipped a camera. So it was cool to see the last bit of development they had on the Red One, which is the first camera.
Yeah.
And start out as like tech support for them, going out on sets, you know, trying to support these big films that were just getting started with this real cutting edge technology. Then eventually got a chance to get my hands on a Gates housing that was built for the Red One, started shooting that. And then, it really took off for me, and I wanted it, but it took off and actually was enabled by the new camera development. Somebody had to get it underwater in an alpha testing situation, you know, before we could really offer it to the public.
Yeah.
And luckily I really injected myself into that scenario. I kind of forced myself into that role and wanted to be the guy to get it underwater. So once we had that first Epic camera that had to get underwater, Gates built a housing for that and let me go run with it. And it continued with every sensor Red made after that. I got to be the first person to get every new sensor underwater through the whole chain of sensors that was made for a while.
So was Red really pushing for the underwater stuff? Was it a genre they really wanted to get into?
Yeah, you know, I think it came from a personal interest more than anything. The camera lends itself perfectly to that world. High frame rates, really high resolution. You know, the Red was the pioneers of 4K realistically. And that technically it makes sense for that world, but realistically what happened is we all love it. You know, the right. Owner of Red, the president of Red, all those cats, they are very into nature films, and it's stuff that just impresses visually, and
right.
Kinda it makes the product shine no matter what, right? But we all also had a very strong interest in both the conservation aspect of the environment, but also telling the stories visually. So yeah, it was a perfect marriage, really.
So what sort of things did you have to take into account with that sort of R&D, like the development to take the Red camera underwater? What sort of things were the factors involved?
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting question, because I would say it turned into an obsession of mine for at least like 3 years, where we had the Dragon sensor come out and there were reports of this magenta shift in water. Everybody called it the big magenta problem. Right. We'd have this crystal clear blue water, but a lot of times with a lot of particulate in it, you know, a lot of kind of sediment stirred up, that type of blue water that, you know, Cayman Islands, sometimes Bahamas, where it's crystal clear, but there's a lot of stuff in the water. And a lot of folks were coming back with footage that kind of looked magenta-ish in their blue water, and it was hard for them to color correct out.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't a real easy repair. And I tapped into some of the greatest minds in the industry. David Blackham, John Shaw were huge helps. And a lot of the research they were already doing was in UV cut filters. Yeah. And they were finding good results out of using these filters that cut the UV spectrum at a certain point. And we really jumped into testing those out, bringing the footage back to genius minds like Graham Natras, who is the color scientist for Red. And he would tweak the footage, start figuring out what was lacking, what was missing, what was shifting, what was happening. Stuff way above my pay grade and definitely above my head, you know.
Right, yeah.
He would come back with kind of data points for what was working and what wasn't. And we developed the underwater OLPF, the UD, you know, optical low pass filter. And what it does is basically cuts UV off at a certain point in the spectrum, lets red through as much as possible because the color red's filtered out first, you know, water, as a lot of us know. So it was very specific to that market, and it was a big effort. Probably not the greatest thing for them to throw out there, but it cost a lot of money for them to develop. And they probably knew that maybe they wouldn't even gain that money back as a product, but that wasn't what was important. What was important was making the footage shine, making this product really work for that market, because we were so interested in it personally.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that I've never even really thought about. Like, you know, I think about the housings, and I think about lighting and all that sort of stuff. I don't think about how the cameras change once we take them underwater. You know, I feel like, you know, that's kind of, that's our problem. You know, that's a post-production problem. But finding out that they've spent that much time to make the camera work better under the water anyway, that's incredible.
Yeah. And it was agonizing at times, but a lot of fun too. You know, we got to take a couple trips to Cayman Islands and do the alpha testing and, you know, jump in the water, shoot some color charts. And once we got done with that, go find some turtles.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's find some moving targets.
Yeah.
So in terms of those kind of changes that were made, are they things that happen in the camera above water as well? Does the camera need to be changed? Like, is there a setting that needs to be changed to tell it that it's now underwater?
No, not necessarily. Early on, you know, if you would do something like install that underwater OLPF, you would have to go into the menus and you would have to tell it you're now using this filter, which is, you know, if you guys aren't familiar with this, it's basically just a filter that's in front of the sensor. It's a piece of glass. And so you're telling it you're now using this filter instead of the one you had previously. So switch your color science to adapt to that filter. Gotcha. And so that was something you had to do manually. But then eventually in the new iteration of the cameras, it had intelligent pins to detect what OLPF you had already put in there. So once you turn the camera back on, it automatically switches all that for you.
Oh, okay. So this is actually like a physical filter that you plug into the camera if you're going to use this.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's amazing. And it made that much difference.
It did. Yeah. In specific environments, especially, you know, that real blue water and shooting back at the surface, things like that, it definitely did. And in certain sensors, it made a bigger difference than others. Dragon needed it. Absolutely. Nowadays, it does make a difference in certain situations, but the OLPFs that Red's producing now in front of the newer sensors are so good and so in tune with a lot of the things that were brought up with that development that they kind of make it negate the use for underwater OLPF at certain times.
Oh, okay. So you can just use the one that's already there.
Yeah, nowadays, you know, you don't have to think about it as much. It's right. more of using the standard OPF will get you by in most situations. Could you optimize it further with the underwater OPF? That's definitely a question to ask. And, you know, in certain environments, it might help.
Yeah. And then so how did the relationship with Gates come about? Did you already have a relationship with them?
You know, the way Gates was introduced to Red was that very first NAB, a mutual friend came over to John Elbrock, who's the owner of Gates, along with his wife, Karen, and introduced him to Red, said, you got to see this. Come check this out. This is like the future of cinema, you know?
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of buzz, you know, that first year or two, there was a ton of buzz. And he introduced him to Jim Gennard, the owner of Red. And Jim looked at John and said, you know, well, we got our underwater guy then. And they had a close relationship developmentally.
Yeah.
All through R&D, you know, there's with a product like Red, you kind of had to keep a lot of stuff secretive because it was so groundbreaking. And John had access to a lot of those secrets in development because of the close relationship. So, you know, NDAs were signed before a lot of folks could get an NDA in front of them. And it's been a strong relationship since, and they've created housings for each one of the cameras that have come out since.
Yeah, they definitely do seem to go hand in hand. Like when you think of Gates, I think of Red and vice versa.
Yeah, and I mean, Gates makes incredible housings for, you know, all the top cameras out there, all the proper Aries that are being used, the Mini and everything that's really out there that's being used commonly. But yeah, it's always been a beautiful marriage what's been done between Red and Gates.
And I think with the thing with Gates too is what I associate with them is custom stuff. Like they seem to be, you know, if there is a camera that maybe hasn't got a housing yet, you know, like Gates seem to be interested in pushing that envelope a bit.
True, yeah. I mean, on the engineering side, they can really tap into something different than I've seen from a lot of folks. And I've watched them do some amazing custom work for a lot of people, like the big BBC shows. Worked with them when Alusha Productions was Alusha Productions before Ocean X evolved, and they created custom housings for their submarines and integrating the Red cameras into those custom housings. And then I came along, kind of helped tie up the loose ends of the camera side of things and got on board Alusha, which was, you know, featured in Blue Planet 2 quite a bit. And a lot of the footage from those submarines featured in that. They do a lot of custom work. And realistically, I have a feeling they could pretty much do anything as long as somebody's willing to fund it, because I've seen them do some pretty wild stuff.
That's it. And I think as engineers, like that must be the fun part. Yeah, kind of the problem solving.
I'd imagine so, yeah. I mean, it's pretty incredible, too, when you see the final results, like the Mega Dome they did, like the split shots that came from that was in Blue Planet 2. That was phenomenal. It just...
Yeah, how big was that dome?
Oh, God, large.
It was like measured in feet, right?
Yeah. It's measured in washing machines, I think, is the new term.
Right.
From what I hear. Yeah, it's definitely... It's large to travel with. It's large to use. You need a little bit of crew. The folks at Esprit did phenomenal jobs of constantly maintaining, buffing out scratches, and supporting the productions that would use that. But and the proof is in the pudding, like they say. You know, to see what came from that was really amazing. And
oh yeah, I mean those split shots and like the BBC stuff, the, you know, the Blue Planet and all that series as a kind of a, I'm not a gear geek, I'm like a visual geek. And just seeing how they would do these shots, it seemed like half the series was trying to do shots that had never been done before.
Absolutely. I felt the same way, because it's kind of come to that point, hasn't it? Where, you know, it's, you got to get some incredible animal behavior. And if that's not what you have in the bag, then it's got to be done in a way that's just never been seen, right? It's got to be completely groundbreaking cinematically, which is very cool. And then when you get both of those together, where you have incredible animal behavior and something that, you know, hasn't been filmed that way before, it's the best.
It's so immersive. You know, like I remember when can't remember what the series was called. Maybe it was Planet Earth, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And, you know, they're using like military grade optics out of helicopters and stuff to chase antelope and stuff around. But the, you know, the distances away that they could get from their subjects meant that they weren't disturbing or, you know, affecting the subjects. So it was so real. It was things that never been seen before.
Yeah, that is the coolest, you know, when you were just there, this literal fly on the wall situation for animal behavior. I mean, it's kind of the goal, right? Is just making sure that you're not influencing anything they're doing.
Yeah. I think at the end of that Planet Earth series, like at the end of every episode, they'd have like a little short documentary on how they got some of the shots. And they would kind of talk about the gear they used and all this sort of stuff. And I think one of the ones that blew my mind was this, you know, long tracking dolly time lapse up this massive pile of bat crap.
Oh, with all the beetles running all over it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just how they set that up, and it was stinking hot, and, you know, it was kind of like camera on a wire sort of thing. And it was just incredible.
I'm with you. That was one of the most incredible BTS things I've ever seen, and made me appreciate that crew so much for what they were doing to go, what they were going through to get it.
Oh, totally. And that's what I get. That's what gets me about wildlife, you know, people in general, is that you never know if you're even going to get the shot. You know, you might do all this work and come away with nothing.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a gamble every time. You try to set yourself up for success best you can, right? Yeah. Try to knock out as many factors as you can to put yourself in the best situation, but it's always a gamble.
So for you, what are you doing? What are your kind of processes to try and get the results?
You know, if it's something I'm doing for myself, it's very different, where I will pre-plan and try to figure out best practices. I mean, a lot of the times I'm being told what folks need and kind of doing it on the fly. I feel like I have excelled a bit in really improvising in the moment, to adapt to whatever's happening in that situation and change whatever our plan might have been to possibly something better if a plan goes out the window. And then if the plan is what we wanted, being able to stick to it, but still being able to put my fingerprint on it a bit and kind of giving it a bit of my own style.
And so is that the sort of thing you're doing on the fly, like once you're under the water shooting, so you kind of can't check in, or is it a semi-approved kind of change?
I've spent a good bit of time filming other people underwater. Other than just animals, it's people doing their thing underwater, and it becomes a fun kind of improv play where I'm responding to what they're doing. You know, yeah. I can't have a preconception of what to do, because I need to base my moves and what I'm doing to cover what they're doing. And it's a really fun game to play, I gotta say. Like, to just improv on the fly and make things up creatively underwater, that's a blast to me.
No, I totally agree. And that's my joy of underwater, is kind of rolling with the punches. You know, like, I like that, you know, seeing what's being thrown at you and then trying to make the best of it. That's kind of my little drug, being under the water creating. So it's interesting to hear you say that as well. And because you do like you've done, you know, filming people and narrative and documentary stuff as well as the wildlife stuff, right?
Yeah. I somehow find myself pointing my lens at people underwater. More than animals. Oh, realistically, okay. There was a whole series of little documentaries we made at Red called The Red Collective. You know, we did one on Paul Nicklin, we did one on Andy Casagrande, and Shannon and Russ, the Wilds, we call them. And it's following them doing their thing, and again, it's going back to that fly on the wall type of thing, trying to not change how they would work and capture their work at the same time and try to capture the energy of their work. And that's a blast to me. And then one of the more recent things I did, which was actually about a year ago now at this point, being out on Ocean X on their maiden voyage, a lot of what I was shooting was following the science and following the teams of scientists and documenting their efforts out there.
Yeah.
And that was a blast, because they're making discoveries every day.
And oh, yeah.
Sometimes underwater, I'm seeing that happen, and it's actually processing that they're extremely excited right now. That must be something totally new to this person.
Yeah, that's right.
they've been looking at all these types of corals, and I'm seeing similar responses. All of a sudden, this scientist is extremely excited.
Right.
You just discover something, I can tell. And then all of a sudden, your energy starts flowing, and then your work starts changing to make sure you're documenting that right and showing the intensity of the moment.
Yeah.
Really fun.
That was one thing I really wanted to talk to you about. And I've actually got it on my notes here. It's underlined, but it's, the submersibles, with the Ocean X and stuff. Mm-hmm. 'Cause you did on your Facebook, you posted some sort of, some images from that trip, I think was it out in the Red Sea?
It was in the Red Sea. Yeah. It was in the waters of Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea. So, most folks see a lot of Red Sea footage from the Egyptian side of the waters, and this expedition was solely in Saudi waters. And one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life, because realistically we were seeing things underwater that we know nobody's been there before.
Oh, wow.
And for better or for worse, because, you're also seeing, tons of fishnet debris and trash and things like that. It's not as bad as some of the places I've been in the world, but you see the human impact. And a lot of folks haven't actually seen that because they've been on the surface in that area, but nobody's been underwater there, fish traps left behind and things like that.
Yeah.
But it was very exploratory. It was very groundbreaking and exploratory. And working the submersibles was phenomenal. Ivan Agerton was one of the main topside DPs, and he did a lot of the sub work, but I also got to do quite a bit of work in the submarines where, you're operating two cameras at a time with your joysticks and your two iPads with Mikhail's full control up, controlling both cameras, switching back and forth from the macro lens to the wide lens, and capturing stuff that, definitely nobody's ever seen.
Yeah.
When we're on scuba and we're at whatever it is, 20 feet to 100 feet, and we're covering that side of things, we know we're seeing things no one has before, but it's a definite when we're down in the submarines, and we got some pretty phenomenal discoveries and some pretty phenomenal animal behavior. And it's just absolutely surreal being in a submarine operation like that, and with the top crew in the world you could ask for, taking you down, keeping you safe, running everything properly. It's really amazing. I mean, Ocean X is absolutely on the forefront.
What sort of depths were you working in the submarines?
That's an interesting one, because not as deep as they would usually go, and it's for a pretty interesting reason, because in the Red Sea and especially that part of the Red Sea. Typically, we all know as divers, as you go deeper and deeper and you hit thermoclines and the water starts getting colder and colder, not so much in that part of the world. The water actually stays extremely warm. So you're basically sitting in this giant acrylic bubble, right?
Yeah.
Those of us that have acrylic domes on the front of our underwater housing, similar to that, but you have humans inside of it, right?
Yeah.
So those acrylic bubbles are rated to a certain depth. But also, that's based off of the fact that the water is getting colder and colder as you go to these deeper depths, so it can withstand a little bit more. But if the water's staying that warm, that actually plays into the integrity of the dome as well. So their math ends up being recalculated to where we can't go that deep.
Oh, because of the warmth of the water changes how strong that dome can be?
Exactly. Wow. Yeah, exactly. And how much it can withstand, how much pressure it can withstand plus the temperature of the water. And so it basically limits the depths to a lot lower depths than they would usually go. But I mean, you're still talking 700-900 meters, you're down there.
That's right.
You're watching all the light disappear, and then you reintroducing light by the onboard lights on the subs.
Yeah. You're still a long way from home.
Very true. Yeah. I got to say, it's a very surreal thing too, especially for anybody's first time in these submarines, when you go through the safety briefing and they have to tell you, and I love them to death. They always start off with, I'm feeling fine today. You're not going to have to do this, but I'm going to have to teach you how to take over just in case something happens to me, and how to get this submarine to the surface.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's all part of the process. It's all part of the safety briefing, but it's very interesting. And I guess I you should probably pay attention to the details there on how to get that submarine to the surface.
That's right. It's like getting on a, like a private jet and then the captain coming out and going, look, I'm feeling okay, but just in case you have to do it, this is how you fly the plane.
Yeah, and then it's shortly followed by, we expect that we'll all be able to hold our bladder, but just in case, this is what you do if not.
Oh.
So there's that safety briefing as well.
Taking a pee at, like, you know, 700 meters below.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing when you know you're going that afternoon or that morning. You know, you maybe don't eat a big breakfast. You maybe don't have that second cup of coffee.
Because how long is the trip? How long does it take you to get down and get back up again?
Yeah, all depends on what we're doing. It could be anywhere from 3 hours, 6 hours to 8. You know, beyond that,
yeah,
it just really depends on what the run is and what the mission is at that time. Typically, we would be doing a couple dives a day. So, you know, somebody would go down in the morning and then they'd switch out scientists and possibly camera folk. You know, the media team would switch out too. But sometime it would be an all day run where, you know, you're 8 to 10 hours or something.
Wow.
And yeah, it was incredible to be in the greatest research vessel I can imagine. The facilities are just mind blowing. Whether it came to the dive operations, the submarine operations, but everything involved, all the science involved on board, it was just top notch. So to be diving 3-4 times a day, and then tomorrow can't dive because I've got to operate cameras on a submarine. Oh, all right.
Yeah.
I guess I'll do that too. It's, yeah, just some, you know, amazing, amazing opportunity.
That's incredible. There was one photo that I saw on your Facebook, and it took me a little bit to kind of work out what was happening, but it was of the SpaceX, you know, submarine, that acrylic dome or bubble. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like you were filming someone inside the submarine filming whilst they were being filmed by cameras on the outside of the submarine.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. It was like this Inception kind of thing going on.
Yeah. It becomes that infinity shot when you just point a camera at a monitor, right?
Yeah.
I think that might have been back in the days of Alusha where we were underneath the boat and I just had a handheld camera in hand. Possibly. I'm not sure what that one was.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I might have been confused with it, but I think there was a camera person inside the sub, but then who probably had a handheld, but then there were cameras attached to the inside of the dome.
Yeah. And I mean, we went all out. If you're going down into uncharted territory, we absolutely had POV cameras, you know, suction cupped. I even did a lot of effort to kind of get the POV aspects proper for some of these shots. And then sure, a lot of times we would have a handheld camera in the sub.
Yeah.
Filming one of the scientists and what their reactions were. Cause one of the submarines is solely there for science. They have the articulating arms to pick up samples and put them in the baskets and stuff like that. Yeah. The other sub would be geared up with the underwater housings. Granted, you could take these housings off and put the arms on if you had to have both subs doing science, but you want to document the science as well. But yeah, it was very common for us to be filming in the media sub with both water housings shooting macro and wide. And then in the other submarine, we'd usually have one of the filmmakers with a handheld camera documenting what the scientists were going through and their reactions and their discoveries on the fly. And those played into some of the short films that OceanX is releasing about the scientists that were on board.
Right. Yeah. And that must have been incredible. What's the communication like with those submarines? Are you tethered, like, or is it just purely on its own?
Yep. Not tethered. Perfect communications to the surface, to each other. Wow. We've got it all figured out.
That's crazy.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. I was lucky enough to visit the manufacturer Triton submarines some years ago, probably this 5-6 years ago, and they're out of Florida.
Yeah.
And to see where they actually assemble these and where they train folks. It is a really incredible leap of technology that they've gone to at this point.
It's, I mean, and this is a nice little segue for me, but it is like building spaceships.
It really is. And it doesn't feel much different than I would think it would feel to be in outer space and to be discovering new things on new planets. But I think we've got one up on Bezos and all those folks, because we get to stay down there longer. It's something that's a lot more easily repeatable. And I don't know. I appreciate making discoveries on our own planet.
Oh,
others.
Yeah.
Let's concentrate on what's going on here.
That's right.
Put our efforts into that first and foremost.
But it's also like so much harder to do that, right? Like, you know, space is easy compared to going to the depths.
It seems like it might be at this point.
Yeah. You know,
just launch something up there and then it just got to come down.
That's right. Yeah.
I don't know who's got more logistics involved, but I feel like it's a lot more fun being under the sea.
Yeah, totally. Well, there's a lot more life down there.
Absolutely. We know that at least.
And yeah.
So much life we don't know about too. And
exactly.
It was very real that on a lot of the dives we were making discoveries. And that's a really incredible feeling. You know, you're not just in somewhere that nobody's ever seen before, but all of a sudden you just made either an animal behavior discovery or a discovery of a new animal or a new coral. You know, they were discovering all kinds of new species of coral and things like that.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to the ROV work, that was also something else I would do on certain days where I might be out diving 2-3 dives in the morning, come back and then operating the ROV, and their setup for the ROV is just incredible. It's like nowhere else. There's so many details I wouldn't even get into because it would get so long winded, but the way they have this thing set up, it's just absolutely top notch. And to be able to bring that thing to depths that the manned submersibles cannot go to.
Yeah.
Really cool. And I mean, there's certain stuff they have not released yet that I can't talk about. I'm sure my V-chip would self-destruct.
Activate. Yep.
But there is some really, really cool stuff that happened out there.
That's incredible. Do you know when that sort of stuff is going to be released? Like when they're going to kind of make that stuff public?
I don't, because certain things have been trickling out as stories about the scientists. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sure they're going to do with some of the bigger discoveries. I wouldn't doubt they'll probably do more concentrated programming on what happened there. But yeah, I'm not sure.
That's amazing. But speaking of the space stuff, because you've done... you've worked on documentaries in terms of the space stuff and working with NASA as well, right?
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, this underwater world just kind of, it translates to space too so many times over. Yeah, the first time I worked with NASA in any capacity, it was at the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, and that was for a documentary called A Year in Space. It was documenting Scott Kelly, who was about to go up to the ISS and spend a year. And nobody had done that length of a trip.
Mm.
And I had the pleasure of filming the underwater scenes with Marco Grob, Jonathan Wood, the producer. And you are in the biggest swimming pool in the world, and you're filming astronauts basically running through the process of what they're going to do when they get up to the ISS. You know, they're training for what operations they have to do with that, switching out this battery or whatnot. And they have a full mock-up of the International Space Station underwater. And you're watching them go through their whole process and documenting that. And it was absolutely amazing.
That must be, because I've seen some footage of that sort of stuff and you know, in documentaries and also in, I think it was like, what, Armageddon? Back in
yes,
the day.
Yeah. It was in Armageddon. It was in Space Cowboys. They have those posters up on the wall. I'm going to have to remember to shout back out to my boys at the NBL and see if we can get a poster up of A Year in Space. Cause it was a big documentary. It ended up winning an Emmy. We were, you know, proud of that, but it was really cool being there. And I remember seeing it in Armageddon and a couple different things. And just went back there actually a couple years back with my friends from Gates, with John, the owner, and, Pete Lightower, and we taught a STO, a Gates STO, which stands for Setup, Test, Operate. And that's kind of the workshops we teach about Gates products, and we did one for their staff there, which already has Gates housings on hand, but they wanted to up their knowledge and also kind of get some more folks involved from the department and teach them how to operate those cameras. So yeah, just went back a second time a couple of years ago, and it is the coolest, most surreal place ever. You know, you feel like you're in space. You really do.
That was my question, was like, you know, while you're down there filming, do you kind of get a bit confused sometimes and then go, oh, hang on, I'm actually just underwater.
You know, I try to detach as much as I can so I can get the job done properly. But you know, there's moments where it hits you how cool it is, how surreal it is. When we were filming for A Year in Space, there was this moment where, you know, they've got the underwater PAs going. So they're announcing, we're about to run the drill for this emergency situation. And I don't really understand exactly what they're saying, but I know it's a kind of uh-oh moment. This is what, if this happens, we have a red alert. You've got to fix this fast or else all hell breaks loose. So we're going to start this drill in 3, 2, 1. And as they start the drill, they start playing Bob Marley, Don't Worry, Be Happy over the PA underwater. It's just the weirdest, surreal moment, looking around at each other. And you're watching these astronauts basically save everybody's life on the fake ISS.
Right.
And
that's amazing.
It hits you then. You can't deny that.
Yeah, totally. That's incredible. With the suits that the astronauts are wearing, are they like closed circuit, or do they have bubbles coming out of them, or?
Yeah, those are closed circuit. Yeah, and it's the same type of suit that they'd be wearing up in space. And, you know, there's a whole team of suit techs that basically not only help them get in and out of the suits, but, of course, they're the ones that are there tweaking it and making sure it's all going to work right for them when they get up there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's all closed circuit. And an interesting thing is, and one of the big efforts they have right when they get in the water is trimming the suit out. You know, for all of us underwater photographers, we know about trimming our housings, right? Making it perfectly balanced. They got to trim the suit out too. So they're putting lead down in the back left calf, counteracting that with some over here and some over there, and getting the astronauts perfectly trim. Then once they're in the water, you know, they need help to move. Unlike when they're in space where they have surface tension and they can actually push off something and really keep moving, since they have the friction of the water underwater, they need help kind of getting pushed around and stuff. So I'm sure that's not their most fun part, because they probably feel a little less astronaut-y.
Like they need assistance. Yeah. And in terms of that, like, so with those suits, do they then have buoyancy control as well? Or is that what you mean in terms of being moved around?
Yeah, that's out of their hands. So basically all the buoyancy control is whatever their assistants are doing to trim their suits out.
Right.
And you know, I get the feeling they have calculations where they get them very close before they even get in the water. And then it was pretty much just more about balancing a bit.
Yeah. And then they're just climbing around on the ISS, I guess.
Exactly. Just going hand over hand over hand. And it's a surreal moment too, in watching them train in the MBL, is when they detach their lanyard. You know, they detach their carabiner to move over to a different part of this fake International Space Station, and then watching them clip the carabiner back in, it's not a big deal because we're in a 40-foot deep pool and you have all this assistant staff around you. But if you think about it enough, that's something they're going to have to do in space, and you don't clip that right and all of a sudden you lose track, you're drifting off into space.
Oh,
you might have a problem.
Yeah. And that's when all the space horror movie stuff kind of comes back to me, where it's
exactly, that's what I was thinking too. Yes.
Cause at least with underwater, like, you're eventually going to hit something, like you're eventually going to stop.
Right.
But in space, depending space on what your orbit is,
you're going to stop when your life support stops, and that's about it.
Exactly. Which, you know, depending on how good your suit is, might be a really long time.
Yeah. And these folks have some pretty interesting stories. You know, we're working with an astronaut, a Russian astronaut, who was famous for being the first person to almost drown in space.
Oh.
They have these cooling systems in their suit, and basically it malfunctioned and it started filling up with water. And it basically put like a baseball, softball size ball of water over his mouth, over the communications, to where he can't even communicate anymore, that he has a problem. And the only thing he attributes his survival to was the fact that he had facial hair. He had a goatee that basically just separated that ball of water off of his mouth enough for him to breathe a bit to get back and grab onto the space station and start working his way in until his partner could tell he had a problem.
That's the crazy stuff. Like the things you don't really think about is, because I think there was something like that where someone had a, like had a tear or an eyelash or something and inside their suit and it kept sticking them in the eye. And so they couldn't see what they were doing. Like the idea that the, you know, everything is foreign. There's no gravity. Things don't work how you expect them to.
Yeah. We think it's bad enough when, you know, we get down to depth on a dive and all of a sudden you see that there's a hair bouncing around in the dome port or something like that. Yeah, they've got a little bit more involved.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so that's a good point. What is the weirdest or probably the worst kind of situation where you've had something like that happen? Where, you know, there's something in the dome or there's a malfunction?
You know, I've had some malfunctions. Yeah. Sure. Some of them not as fun to talk about as, than others. I would say a weird situation I have had before, and this was in Indonesia, and at depth, everything seems right. You know, you've done all the checks you could possibly do before buttoning it back up after putting new media and battery in, and you get down to depth, and all of a sudden, something keeps moving in my LCD. What is that? Something keeps, and you know, there's plenty of things bouncing around in the ocean, so you figure it's a small fish out in front of the dome, is something like that. But it's just so consistent that it's in my shot no matter where I point. It took me a minute or so to realize, yeah, there's a small fly or a gnat, you know, and the dome bouncing in front of the lens.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so that's not fun.
So you had a hitchhiker.
Yeah, you just try to kind of welcome it towards the back of the housing a little bit and see if you can get a couple shots without it in front of the lens.
Yeah, that's crazy. And not something I'd ever really, again, not something I'd really thought of happening. That's crazy.
I don't even know how he snuck in there. It was a quick move.
But do you now check? Do you now do a fly check?
A fly check? Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, I definitely have my checklist before jumping in and making sure everything is ready to go. And that is now in the back of the mind, I guess. You know, yeah. You know, when you look at that dome port, definitely look for anything moving.
I think that's the thing. Like once I got into underwater, I think I've done everything wrong once. You know, you only need to do it once to realize that you never want to do it again.
Yeah. How else are you going to get better? Right.
Yeah. You know, I've done dives where I'm at, you know, not at depth, but at like 20, 30 feet down and realized that my, the autofocus button on my lens is turned to manual and I can't change it. So, you know, I've got no way of, and now I have gears on my housing so I can do manual focus, but this was before then. So I was like, oh God, like I'm out of focus for this whole thing.
It's a showstopper. Yeah.
Yeah. And terrible. It's a showstopper if you didn't realize until you got back to the ship and then suddenly you realize everything you took was out of focus.
Yeah. And been there, done that too, where it's not noticeable in the image. You didn't see it in prep, but there might be just the tiniest spot on the back of a lens or something like that. And then it's heartbreaking, you know, especially if you got something good and you realize now, is that a fix it in post situation?
Yeah.
Not even going to happen.
No, that's the thing. And I think learning how to edit and how to do post-production and stuff really makes me appreciate how well we have to do as camera operators and do our job properly so that it makes the other end easier.
True.
And to put it all together.
And I think everybody, whether you want to do it for yourself, for a profession, regardless, you should learn editing. And I mean, not just learn the software, not just learn the tools, but learn the mindset of editing, because that's only going to help you film better. You know, especially when we're talking about motion footage, I mean, you kind of have to put yourself in the editor's place. You know, from a director's standpoint, you're always thinking like that. But from a camera operating standpoint, sometimes folks are just worrying about getting the shot, nothing else. Whereas if you can step that up to thinking about how that shot will cut into the next shot. And, you know, not as basic as just making sure you get the wide, get a mid and get a close up. That's great too. But also like the motion of your shots, how are you looping around from left to right behind this subject is that really going to work for your next shots? If you can think like that as a cinematographer, I think you have a really big leg up on things.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I got from, you know, from Pete Romano's and the SOC's underwater cinematographers workshops was learning about, you know, clean ins and outs and the different types of shots that you can do that will help. Yes. The edit, that's going to help the narrative. You know, like I guess if your subject is always in frame, it's really hard to cut from that to something else.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the clean ins and outs, I mean, at a minimum, you know, that's something that your editors and your director will just bless you for forever and want to rehire you for, because yeah. If nothing else, you know, take that extra few seconds to get them a clean out and to be able to have a clean frame to cut.
And are you shooting like kind of B-roll stuff at the same time? Are you kind of keeping an eye out for that sort of stuff?
Sure, it depends on the project. You know, there is a lot of projects where I'm the single shooter and I have a single purpose and I kind of know what we have to do. But at the same time, sure, constantly trying to shoot B-roll if you can, if the subject matter dictates it, you know, if it's more of a, you know, doing tank work and pool work and things like that. Of course, you have a kind of a sole objective, right? But yeah, once you're out there in the ocean, if my objective is to film this scientist and they're studying this piece of coral, then I've absolutely blown it if I haven't spent another 5 minutes plus or whatever filming this coral after they kick away from it.
Yeah.
And really getting the inserts that are going to help the editors tell the story.
And do you have a preference for the open water as opposed to tanks? Like, are they just different beasts and you like them both? Or do you have a preference for the which place to shoot in?
Certainly different beasts. You know, if I had a preference, I mean, my heart is, of course, in the ocean. But there is something really special about tank work and, like, feature film TV work, where it's a different energy and it's a different adrenaline. It's a different just perspective on your work.
Yeah.
And I love that too. You know, a movie that just came out about a month ago, The Colony, was the DP is Marcus Forderer. Real brilliant stylized DP, and the world he created visually is just phenomenal. And I was lucky enough to shoot the underwater sequences for that. And the movie actually starts out with an underwater sequence, which was really cool to me.
Yeah.
You know, like, my work has to be immersive because that's the immediate thing you're going to see when you start watching this movie. And luckily, you know, set up for success by that production and what they did. And it was a really interesting environment to shoot in. You know, they shot in all kinds of locations, but the underwater sequences we shot for the beginning of that film was a wave tank, basically, in outside of Hamburg, Germany.
Yeah.
And it was built with the purpose of teaching people how to survive a helicopter crash.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, these folks that are going out to the oil rigs, more so in that area, I think more out to the windmills. You know, they're not into the oil rigs as much as we are here in Southern California, thankfully.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it had wave machines on all four corners that could send 2-meter waves at you from four different directions at once, which we did, of course.
Yeah.
And we had simulated pouring rain with giant wind turbines. And then you add in floating pieces of flaming debris and, you know, shooting split shots of that and stuff.
Yeah.
It was so fun.
Oh, you know, I can imagine.
I can't imagine being an AD on that. It had to be terrifying and all of that. But to be a shooter in that situation, oh, it was so much fun.
That was like an extreme sport, right?
It kind of was. Yeah. It was quite the adventure. But yeah, that was the last day of three shooting those opening sequences. And a lot of it, other than that, was basically shooting the simulation of this space capsule plunging underwater and then falling to the depths of the sea while our heroine rescues people or tries to rescue people and herself and get out of this thing.
Yeah. What sort of technical challenges do you have in a situation like that, where you've got, you know, massive waves coming through and set pieces and props kind of coming into the water?
Yeah, technical challenge wise, I mean, you had, I would say logistically challenged was the fact that, you know, the big pieces of flaming debris would all of a sudden up their anchor and start moving closer towards you and closer towards you and things like that, which I could tell it probably freaks out some people that were in the water there, but it was more interesting to me. I could get more flame in the foreground. It was fun.
Yeah, that's right. Bring it closer.
Yeah, the overall though, for that shoot, I would say one of the biggest technical challenges was lens choice. Marcus loves to shoot anamorphic, and he shoots pretty much everything on anamorphic lenses when he can. And Hawk made this set of vintage 74s that were in a 65 mil format, you know, because it was a shot on Monstro, so it had to be a full frame coverage lens. And it was also their vintage version of these lenses. And there was one set of them in the world. Right. That was it.
Yeah.
So literally them handing me this lens that I had to make fit into my housing. Big props to Gates again for being so adaptive and so flexible with the way they design their products, because for me to even fit this lens in, let alone optimize it and make it work properly.
Yeah.
It was quite the feat. I mean, it was, you know, I had clearance of a millimeter on lens gears and things like that.
Wow.
But it was also just a giant hunk of glass. So I had a foam ring I wrapped around the front of the port extender to try to help the front float a bit. That still wasn't enough. So I put two float arms pointed out towards the front of the housing. We just kind of ended up calling it the insect or the bug because it had two antennas, basically.
Right.
You know, no lights on the float arms, just for straight buoyancy. And got it about as close as I can to being really neutral and properly trimmed. And it was very close. But of course, once you start adding stuff like that, that starts to take away from your kind of hydrodynamic aspect, all your, you know, it's a little harder to push something through the water and really do dynamic shots with it.
Yeah. So how did you find that? Did it, you then have to adjust the shots you were going for, or you just had to push harder?
I would say I probably just pushed harder, but
yeah,
I'm sure subconsciously I was making all kinds of adjustments, but tried not to concentrate on that and just get the job done.
Yeah, totally.
But very interesting lenses to shoot with, you know, like just shooting anamorphic underwater in general and making sure you can actually get a proper close focus to get through the, you know, the virtual image on the dome port, and, you know, diopters all day with anamorphics, but
yeah,
you can make it work. It's just always an interesting challenge. And luckily I had a production that was not going to rush. They were not going to do anything hastily. It was plenty of time for me to prep, you know, filled up a pool in the back of the studio in Berlin where we were prepping and where they were currently shooting, just so I could kind of test diopters.
Right.
So yeah, set up for success. And that's a huge thing. You know, you can certainly get hired by some jobs that just don't get that underwater work is a different animal. You know, you can't rush things, you know, whatever you're used to, it's probably going to take a lot longer than that. And really, you got to give your team plenty of time to prep and plenty of heads up on what you're actually expecting and what you're planning on doing. Whereas some folks just think, well, just show up and we're going to shoot this thing.
Yeah. So with this production, was there someone on the production already who knew how underwater worked? Like, did Marcus kind of have a good experience and know that it was going to take a lot longer?
I feel like Marcus probably knows everything about cinematography in the world, but he would never shove it in your face or anything like that. But he's a brilliant cinematographer, so he totally has his head wrapped around it.
Yeah.
He knows. But very importantly, they didn't skimp. They made it a focus, you know, and possibly some of that is because it was the opening sequence of the movie, but they hired a full underwater team.
Yeah.
So they had a full local team of utility divers. I had folks on the surface that were a dry tech plus just kind of organizing things. I had underwater assistants. And then, of course, you had the safety divers that were more concentrated on the talent, taking care of them, and brilliant safety divers that were keeping the talent real calm and comfortable with the situations they were going to be in, because there were some pretty gnarly situations, to be honest. You know, you're in enclosed environments, had to simulate them being strapped into these, you know, these chairs in the space capsule and things like that. And you're talking about folks that aren't experienced with water work at all. Yeah. And that's, I mean, I can't imagine. That's got to be extremely intimidating. Now we're going to put you strapped into this chair and plunge this thing underwater. And don't worry, you're not actually going to be stuck. But, you know, from a mental perspective, it's got to be pretty, pretty tough for a lot of actors. But these safety divers that we had out there were just, they were top notch.
I think that's an interesting thing with the actors, you know, like, you know, I've spoken to quite a few people now and sort of getting their perspectives on how actors deal with this kind of thing. Like some of them love it and can't get enough of the, you know, the sort of the comfort zone pushing sort of thing. Whereas other people are like, you know, like this is scaring the crap out of me. But it really must make the performance really come home when they're, you know, feel like they might die themselves.
Sure, you don't have to fake that look of terror.
Yeah, exactly.
You actually feel like you might be drowning. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, they did phenomenal. It's especially, you know, I know there were some folks that were way outside their comfort zone and it was amazing to watch them overcome it.
Yeah.
And then not just overcome it, but bring it into their performance and embrace it and really, really make something of it.
Absolutely. Now, there's something I just wanted to go back to, which was the anamorphic lenses. Can you just give us an overview for people who don't know the difference between anamorphic and spherical lenses? Like, why are they so special?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, it comes down to a different look. You know, technically, you're talking about a square frame that ends up getting re-stretched out in your monitor and stretched out in the projection that you're watching. But that aspect isn't really that important compared to just what it does to an image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about bokeh a lot, you know, where these out of focus lights really bloom in a certain way, or, you know, or lights flare in a very certain way. That's definitely a very specific characteristic to a lot of anamorphics is how lights flare.
Right.
A lot of times you see those horizontal streaky flares and it's very stylistic, but overall too, it has a different kind of softness in a good way. You know, a lot of times in photography and cinematography, we're so scared of things being soft. You know, we need sharp focus. We need to make sure the resolution and the focus is there. And then you could soften it up later if you have to. But anamorphics bring this organic softness to things, if you will, in general, you know, in every different piece of glass. I can't just speak to one anamorphic lens like I can the rest, because they all just have their own characteristics. They're different animals. They're different paintbrushes. They can be very experimental. And at times you can get a lot of happy accidents out of it. I don't feel like somebody like Marcus goes for happy accidents. I think he knows what he's going to get when he puts a certain lens on a camera and he's setting up his lighting and he's setting up his scene. For me shooting underwater, they allowed me to improv a lot too, which I love. The director, Tim Felbon and Marcus really said, you know, after you get done shooting what we're asking you to shoot for that scene, if you see something that you think's interesting, go for it.
Oh, cool.
They really let me just kind of fly with that. And it was really, really a cool thing. Very empowering for one personally, but also it's just kind of lend itself to a different type of energy to know to always be looking and searching for something different we could capture that wasn't expected.
And which is, I think that's the gift that underwater gives you, is that kind of, you know, you never know what you're going to get. Things are moving, things are changing, the light's changing. You know, you kind of, it gives you these surprises every now and again.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's what's so fun about it, isn't it? Is I love conceptualizing things and starting with that, but it's, the most fun part of it is when all of a sudden something new just happens, a new spark of energy happens out of nowhere. It's very fun.
Oh yeah. And then that's kind of, you know, when you look at your monitor and you kind of scream silently to yourself.
Yeah. Screaming bubbles. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Sean, this has been amazing, man. Just hearing your experiences and everything. I get to talk to you all day about this stuff. And your depth of knowledge is just amazing. Thanks for sharing it.
Oh, thank you so much, Brett. Appreciate it. Yeah, appreciate what you do. And I love seeing your work. And I appreciate you appreciating mine. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, man. We'll speak soon.
All right.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And as always, if you like the podcast, please subscribe, review, and share. If you'd like to support with the production of these episodes, you can purchase our very cool merchandise at theunderwaterpodcast.com. We've got branded coffee mugs, stickers, beer cozies, and posters featuring our amazing illustration and logo by Joe Hodenow. If you'd like to connect with us or learn more about our guests, you can reach us at theunderwaterpodcast.com or on Instagram. We also have a Facebook group where you can discuss the episodes and even get your questions answered by our guests. There's a link to it in the show notes. Also, don't forget about Waterproof magazine, showcasing the best in underwater art. Read it online or purchase a print edition at waterproofmag.org. You can learn more about my underwater photography workshops and mentoring at brettstanley.com or brettsphoto on Instagram. The Underwater Podcast is presented and produced by me, Brett Stanley, and our music is Neo by Oh Boy. Keep creating, everyone. I'll see you in the water.